Well, I may surprise you right now. I'm going to have you turn to 1 Kings chapter 10. I appreciate these two young men in the back that showed up tonight. They are at a conference in Ann Arbor and decided to drive up for our Bible study tonight, so I appreciate that greatly. I was thinking when we talked about camp tonight, one of my favorite pictures of Kevin there is when we were at the Wilds years ago, and he and his brother are both basketball players. They're about the same height, and then they had two friends, the Dalrymple boys, who are both basketball players. In fact, one of them's been here traveling with the Pettit team, I believe, or Gulkin team. And John is 6'8", 6'9", and Mark's about 6'7", 6'8". And then we had another boy in our youth group at that time who was 6'10", 6'11". And I had the picture of all five of them next to me, and I was like, this is my starting five right here. And I was so brave challenging anybody that wanted to play us in a game of basketball that week because I had all these guys. But I really enjoyed that a lot. And it's good to see you guys tonight. 1 Kings chapter 10, I want to start by giving us a little background on our author, the author of Ecclesiastes, King Solomon. In 1 Kings chapter 10, I want you to look at verse 14 as we get a little background on him. 1 Kings 10:14 says, "Now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold." And just in round figures, a little bit more than $1.1 billion in today's currency in 1 year. Verse 15, "Besides that, he had of the merchantmen and of the traffic of the spice merchants and of all the kings of Arabia and of the governors of the country. And King Solomon made 200 targets of beaten gold. 600 shekels of gold went to one target. And he made more gold things." Verse 18, "The king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with the best gold. The throne had six steps, and the top of the throne was round behind, and there were stays on either side on the place of the seat, and two lions stood behind the stays." I mean, there were no expenses spared for what he built. In verse 21, "And all King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None were of silver. It was nothing accounted of in the days of Solomon." Solomon possessed so much gold that he had literally rendered the price of silver worthless. He had that much gold in his possession. And then you get to verse 23. "So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom. And all the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. And they brought every man his present, vessels of silver and vessels of gold and garments and armor and spices, horses and mules, a rate year by year." Solomon, if I could say it this way, was the star attraction of his day. I mean, people were literally flocking to come see him and to ask him questions and to just see his wealth and all these things going on. You and I can't even comprehend the magnitude of this. He was the equivalent of the world's smartest man, and as well as the strongest leader of the time, as well as the richest man in the world, all boiled into one. Solomon had everything at his disposal at one time. I mean, if you compare the American dream today to him, and he would look at it and go, "What is that?" He had everything. And then you look at chapter 11, verse 1. "But King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites, of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, 'You shall not go into them, neither shall they come in unto you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods.' Solomon clave unto these in love, and he had 700 wives, princes, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father." And by the end of chapter 11, Solomon is dead. Now I want you to turn over to Ecclesiastes. Last week we worked through Proverbs, which was a little easier than 150 chapters in Psalms. And Ecclesiastes is even better. There's only 12 chapters. But it is a fantastic book, and we're going to try to survey a number of parts of it, give you a nice exposure to several components of the book, and in the meantime, also show how it fits into the storyline of the Bible. The book itself was really intended to be a book written towards a younger audience. It contained nuggets of wisdom and a perspective that was supposed to be helpful to them. And there's a reason there's not a lot of 20-year-olds that write an autobiography, and that's because they really haven't lived long enough to share enough life experiences and wisdom and things like that that people would actually want to listen and read. And here's Solomon writing something right before us. You know, we've all read books or seen books written by men who were experts in their field or men that had really accomplished something. I remember as we're thinking about Kevin and James here for their business conference, I remember the very first conference I went to out of college, and it was on management and leadership. It was hosted by the winningest coach in the history of the NFL, Don Shula. And so everybody would go through, and of course you had to buy Don's book, and then he would autograph the inside for you. But you listened because when a guy's talking about coaching or leadership, who is the all-time leader in NFL wins, you look at him and says, that man has credibility. That's somebody I'm going to listen to. That's somebody that's been through this. He's accomplished it, and he has something to share. Well, you're holding in your hands tonight a divinely inspired book written by a man that was the world's richest and world's wisest. I think he has some things to share with us. I think he has some things that should perk our ears up a little bit and say, wow, he really has a perspective here. He's lived this. He's understood this. And he has some things that he can share with us that would be practical. If we were to market this as a book today, just with those credentials, it would be a bestseller. People would go, the world's wisest man, the world's richest man? I want to know exactly what he has to say. And you look at Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1, Solomon's book, and he begins it this way, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, so far so good. Verse 2, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? Now, I'm not about to tell the world's wisest man how to write a book, but this is not a really good beginning if you want to catch someone's attention. Here, I want to tell you about it. From the wisest, richest man in the world, everything's vanity. It's all. And immediately we're introduced to one of the most profound themes in the entire book of Ecclesiastes, this idea of vanity. The word vanity is found, as you can see on your handout, over 30 times in the book. It signifies something that's temporary, something that's frail, that's weak, it disappears. One commentator used the word vapory. And it reminded me of the verse from James 4 when it says, whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. And that's really what Solomon is conveying a little bit. It's this idea of vanity. It's weak. It's nothing. It disappears. There's no meaning to it. It's of little consequence. It's temporary. And right at the beginning of the book, chapter 1, verse 2, and right at the end of the book, chapter 12, verse 8, just a few verses before the end of the book, he repeats the same exact line. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. Now, what is he describing as vanity? What is temporary? What is frail? What disappears? Well, I listed a number of these on your paper just for the sake of time. There's a number of them that make sense. You know, he says dreaming is vanity. Well, we say that all the time, especially as parents. Get your head out of the clouds. Come on, you know, get some work done. Stop daydreaming. He says the love of money. The laughter of fools, injustices among humans in our interpersonal relationships, these are all vanity. Those make sense, but there's some surprising ones as well, and I want us to look at them just quickly. Look at chapter 1, verse 17. Ecclesiastes 1:17, he says, and I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit. It's another word that he's going to use several times in here. Then he goes on, look at chapter 2, verse 1. I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. And behold, this also is vanity. Look over just a few verses, verses 4 through 11. He talks about work and wealth and success all being vanity. Look over at chapter 4, verses 13 to 16. Ecclesiastes 4:13, better is a poor and a wise child than an old and foolish king who will be no more admonished. For out of prison he cometh to reign, wherein also he that is born in his kingdom becometh poor. I considered all the living which walk under the sun, with the second child that shall stand up in his stead. There is no end of all the people, even of all that have been before them. They also that come after shall not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and vexation of spirit. Public approval, popularity, to having the popular vote is vanity. It means nothing. It's meaningless. It's temporary. He goes on to chapter 7. This one is even surprising. Chapter 7, verse 15. All things have I seen in the days of my vanity. He almost looks at his own life and says, why am I here? What is the purpose? My own life, this is vanity. There is a just man that perisheth in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man that prolongeth his life in the wickedness. Remember, there's a little bit of a theme here that we've seen a number of times. Psalm 73 did it. Job talked about this, where you look at it and go, the righteous man is dying, and the wicked guy is getting more life, and it doesn't make sense. And Solomon boils it down to this theme of, it's just vanity. It's just one more example of vanity. It's temporary. It's gone. Look over at chapter 11, verse 7. And I told you with 12 chapters, we're going to try to give you a good feel for the book as a whole. Chapter 11, verse 7, he says, truly the light is sweet, and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. But if a man live many years and rejoice in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. All that cometh, all the days that come, the future even, is vain. It's temporary. And in the last one, chapter 11, verse 10. Therefore remove sorrow from thy heart and put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. Man, that energy, that youth, I don't know about you, there's days where I go, boy, it'd be really nice to have that back sometime. And Solomon just lumps all these things that you'd expect, and then things that you're confused at. You go, wow, I'm not sure where he's getting at. And he paints this picture again of, it's all vanity of vanities. Now, this sounds nothing like Joel Osteen's Your Best Life Now book, right? This is a much different approach to the Christian life or to our walk today. So what did the author do? What was Solomon's prescription at this point? He just locked himself in his palace and ate whatever they had and didn't do anything. He just resolved himself to just live out the rest of his days and die? No, he took a few things. He did a number of things. In fact, he tried to fill that void. He tried to fill that emptiness, that vanity, with a number of different approaches. And I want us to take a few minutes to look through several of these approaches. I listed them on your paper for this reason. Because man still attempts to do the same thing today. Not only the unbeliever, many times it's easy for us to look at them and go, oh, look, they're just trying to find meaning in every other place and they're not going to find it till they come to Jesus. That's true. But how many times have professing Christians who have placed their faith in Jesus Christ still try to find their security and their confidence and their comfort and their meaning in something other than Jesus Christ? And so the book of Ecclesiastes really is a powerful reminder to you and I to make sure our perspective is right. As parents, it's an incredible reminder. And we're going to talk about this in a second because I fear we live in an age in which the generations behind us look to at least one thing as the answer to their confidence and success and meaning in life. And it doesn't always center around Jesus Christ himself. One of the things that Solomon tried is back in chapter 2. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. He tried something that we would just summarize as hedonism. Perhaps you've heard that word. It's just indulging in any type of pleasure. Look at Ecclesiastes 2, verse 1. I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure. And behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. He continues on with a number of different things that he used to try to fill that emptiness in his life. Even today, I remember a young man that worked with me years ago telling me about the vacation he was taking with his wife, and they were going down to a resort that was literally called hedonism. And I realized there's more of them popping up all over the place today. At a full resort where adults go, and the whole point is you just cast aside any type of restraint and you do whatever you think will bring pleasure to you. And whatever happens here, it just stays here and no one will know about it. And it's dominant in our society today. Who has the right to tell you you can't do this? If it feels good, do it. If you want to do it, do it. And Solomon, the wisest man of all time, the richest man, the man who probably indulged in more hedonism, at least with 900 women here, says it's all vanity. It's temporary. It's meaningless. It does nothing. Let me ask you a question. Why does the concept of hedonism not satisfy someone? You always want more. Give me an example of something in life. I mean, I'm thinking immediately of drugs. M&Ms? Like I said, drugs, okay? I'm going to have an intervention afterwards for M&Ms. But you ever think, you know, a lot of people say, well, I'm just starting with marijuana. I'm just starting with this and I'll be fine. But what happens after a while? It wears off, right? That excitement, that buzz, that whatever it gave now just becomes a little bit more dull. And so they do what? They escalate to the next level. It's the same thing with relationships often. That's why you see people who typically get involved in immorality and going outside the bounds of marriage. It's typically not just one time or with one person, because after a while that gets dulled. In fact, I read an incredible article, and I think it was just a secular article, but they talked about why there are so many actors and actresses and models who have gone to the homosexual lifestyle. And they said the reasoning, or at least this study said the reasoning, was because those people, in their capacity as these popular, rich people with good looks and all that, had conquered everything that they could conquer within the opposite sex, and now they were looking for satisfaction or meaning in the other direction. But it makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, if that's what you're searching for meaning, if that's what you're looking for satisfaction, at some point it just continues to dull and you have to go to the next level. And Solomon, the wisest man of all time, says, I tried all of that and it's vain. It was empty. He tried something else. Look at chapter 2, verse 18. He says, yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. He engaged himself in work. How many of us have been guilty at different times of becoming workaholics? We plunge ourselves into it, and maybe we're so enamored with a title or a position or a salary level that we just jump in and it engulfs us, and our entire life centers around our career. He says in verse 18, yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. I'm building the temple. I'm building a kingdom. I'm ruling over this entire part of the world. But I'm going to die, and I'm going to leave it to someone else, and it's not going to be mine. In fact, they're not even going to remember me, he says later on. He says, even this work, I tried hedonism. That didn't work. Now I've gone to just putting myself into building a palace and a temple and all these other things, and I found that to be lacking. There's another one. He talks about cynicism later on, where he just takes the approach of being sarcastic and looking around, and there's no meaning in anything. And even that philosophy of mind just was not satisfying to him. But there's one more I really wanted us to focus on. It's over in chapter 5. It's over in chapter 5. And it's that of materialism. You look at Ecclesiastes 5:10. He that loveth silver shall not be what? Satisfied with silver. Nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. What does that last phrase mean? What's that last phrase mean? The abundance of the rich will not allow him to sleep. Once you get it, you've got to try to keep it. It's all you can think about. Well, what's going to happen over here? You read stories of the powerful CEOs today, and I read a story the other day, just the other day, and this lady is now a high-powered CEO. She goes, I just had to sit down with my family and tell them, this is the stage of life I'm in right now, and they're not going to see me for several years. Because they got to work 7 hours a day, 16, 17 hours a day, and 7 days a week, and just plow through all that. Because why? Because once you have it, you can't let go of it. You've got to stay on top of it. You read that whole passage going all the way through chapter 6, verse 12, and it's very telling. And I fear, folks, that we live in a day and age where it's not just the younger generation that that is afflicted with this, but even our own. It amazes me how many good people, good Christians, get caught up in the materialism of this world. When you begin talking to people who have high school students or college students, and everything seems to center around, well, go here and do this so that you can get this type of job and make this type of income and do this or here. Now, there's nothing wrong with planning. I get that. And there's details that we have to work through. But at times, it almost seems like the parent is living vicariously through the child of, if you really want to be satisfied, if you want to have a powerful 401k, if you want to get the stock options, be able to retire at 55, 60, and have the boat and the lake house and all this kind of stuff, then you need to do this, 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 and this. And Solomon, who was getting about $1 billion a year in gold, looks at it and says, it's vanity. You're chasing after a vapor. And it's so easy to get caught up in it. Why? Because money seems to run the world. You know, money doesn't buy everything, but it certainly helps, right? It doesn't buy you happiness, but it seems to buy everything else. And so you get so caught up in the American dream, and you look ahead, and well, I want to retire and do this or this or that. And we go back to that verse in James 4 where I can just see God looking at us saying, your life's like a vapor. You're not even going to get to 65, young man. And what are we chasing after? We find our security in our bank account? I thought we were supposed to find our security in the rock, that strong tower, that mighty fortress that is our God. And Solomon just lays it out on the page for us that this stuff is just vanity. You're just chasing after stuff that's going to be gone. So once again, we're brought back to that statement, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. Now, the purpose of the snapshots is to help us understand how the book fits into the overall storyline of the Bible. I want to do this two ways. I want to look at first, how does the book of Ecclesiastes fit into the books of wisdom? We've looked at Proverbs, we've looked at Job, and now we're into Ecclesiastes. We'll get into Song of Solomon in 2 weeks. So these books of wisdom, how does Ecclesiastes first fit into that, and then how does it fit into the story of the Bible as a whole? Doesn't Ecclesiastes so far seem a little bit different from Proverbs? Proverbs is always kind of the positive side. Do this, here's the contrast, this is the good guy, this is the bad guy, so you want to do this. And almost general principles, if you do this, this is going to happen. The flip side, now you have Ecclesiastes going, we see all the negative stuff, we're seeing all these kinds of things, but it's still a book of wisdom. Someone has said this, Proverbs is written about wisdom to people who want to achieve success, but Ecclesiastes is written about wisdom to people who think they've already achieved success. But it's not satisfying. It's not what they thought it was. It hasn't amounted to everything that they thought it would do in their own life. So look over at chapter 5, verse 15. He says, as he came forth of his mother's womb, this is in that section about materialism, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a sore evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he that hath labored for the wind? Now, does that first verse sound familiar to you? Where have you heard something like that before in something we've studied? Job. Isn't that exactly what Job says? But when does Job say it? Naked came I from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. It's after he lost everything. All right, so here's Job. Job had all these things. He lost everything, and it's at that point he looks to God and says, I came in with nothing, and I'm leaving with nothing. What's the difference between that and Solomon? Solomon is saying it when, Eric? He still has it all. So you see both ends of the spectrum. You see the man that's lost it all saying, I didn't bring anything in, I'm not taking anything out. And you see the guy that still has everything, and he's saying the same exact thing. I've got everything and more I could ever want and need, and I'm not taking it with me. It's meaningless. It's temporary. It's a vapor. And so you see, at least in terms of the wisdom literature, how Ecclesiastes fits a little bit in there. It's a little different than Proverbs. It's just presenting it from a different perspective, but it's saying the same thing. And with that, it helps us draw a little bit closer to how it fits into the overall storyline. Look at chapter 3. The writer of Ecclesiastes mentioned a number of things that he thought were vanity, things that made life meaningless. But what was the final straw? What was the one thing that Solomon looked at and said, because of this one thing, I can look at anybody in the face and say, it's all vanity. Chapter 3, verse 18. I said in mine heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they themselves are beasts. For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them. What is that one thing? As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. All go unto one place. All are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. What is that one thing that he viewed as the cause for making the pleasure of life and the popularity of life and the youthfulness of life and the wealth of life and even wisdom at times absolutely meaningless? Everybody dies. You're like, wow, this is the most discouraging message I have ever been to in my life. It gets better, okay? We got to get to a point. And plus, don't shoot the messenger. Solomon wrote it, okay? But he's saying, I'm looking at this whole thing, and whether you're righteous or wicked, whether you're rich or poor, whether you're healthy or sick, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, we all do what? We all die. Now, Solomon says, death in itself strips away some of the meaning of life. And Ecclesiastes is such a fascinating book. In fact, it could be depressing if you didn't read it. I'll say this. If you don't read Ecclesiastes through the lens of Scripture as a whole, it could come across as very confusing and very depressing. In fact, many commentators say Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon are the two most misunderstood books in the entire canon of Scripture. And you're looking at me going, well, you're doing a pretty good job of confusing it tonight, too. That's why I think our series, The Snapshots, for Ecclesiastes really makes it helpful. Because we're going to step back a little bit, and instead of just focusing on vanity of vanities, all this kind of stuff, what is he drilling home? We're going to look at the big picture, okay? We could look at the storyline of the Bible. Stay with me, because we're nearing the end. You could look at the entire storyline of the Bible, as we've been doing it now for 16, 17, 18 weeks, and divide it into three components. Component number one is this, that God made you. That God is the creator of everything, and that God made you to be in a perfect relationship with him, that God's plan was always perfect and everything was great. Garden of Eden, it was utopia, really, and everything was set. That's one component. Second component is what? What's the next thing that happens? We messed it up, right? Sin. Man rebels against God. God never moves. He's right here. Man moves away from God. He rebels. He sins. Now he's apart, that relationship has been broken, and it changes the entire course of history. Everything changes from that. And what are some of the consequences of that rebellion? Death. Both physical death and spiritual death. You are now separated from the God, the creator that made you. So the component number one, God made everything. It was created perfect, perfect relationship. Component two, man rebelled by sin. There are consequences of that sin. What would be the third major component of the overall storyline of the Bible? Redemption. God's plan, God's love, God's mercy, God's grace shown towards man, his rebellious creation, in providing a mediator, an advocate, a substitute to be a go-between, that man could be redeemed back and get back to a right relationship with God. So you have these three components. And books of the Bible, all 66, will emphasize maybe one more than the others, or some will show all three. Can you think of a book of the Bible that we've studied so far in the snapshots that would have strong elements of all three of those components? I'm really making you think on that one, but it's good. I heard it. Who said it? Dave? Psalms? Okay, I could see Psalms. I'm thinking of another one, yeah. Genesis. Okay, so Genesis, you have the perfect creation. You've got the creation account. Then you have the fall of man. In fact, you could almost say the first three chapters shows it all. Because by Genesis 3:15, you have what? You have the promise, the foreshadowing of the gospel, right? And so you see all three of those in there. There are other books that would emphasize one more than the other. Okay, I think you see where I'm going with this, and for the sake of time, we'll jump right ahead. Where does Ecclesiastes, which one of those three components does Ecclesiastes focus on? That's not rhetorical. I actually want to hear something. The fall, the second one, right? The fall of man, the sinfulness of man. What is Solomon getting to? He's showing the baseline, the main component right there is we all die. And why do we die? Because we rebelled. We moved away from God. And what does man still do today that Solomon was doing then? He tries to fill that void that can only be filled by God himself through Jesus Christ. Man tries to fill that void within him. This is Romans 1. There's no man that truly is an atheist. Everybody can walk outside, see creation, and go, there's a God. That's why it says the fool has said in his heart, not his mind, that there is no God. He knows that there's a God. And so there's this void that can only be filled with God, and man goes about filling it with everything he possibly can, trying to force hedonism in there and materialism and his work and anything else he can possibly find. But it's like taking a round block and trying to put it into a square hole. It doesn't fit. And so Solomon in Ecclesiastes shows this perfect little snapshot of this is the consequence of what you did. This is the consequence of sin. You continue to run away from God. You continue to try to fill it any other way, but there's only one way for you to find the meaning in life. Right? There's only one way. And it's not through any of these other attempts you've been making. Someone has said that outside of the passages in the New Testament related to the cross, no scripture better captures the devastating effects of sin than the book of Ecclesiastes. You could achieve everything you wanted from a worldly human perspective, but you would eventually find it entirely meaningless and vain, for man cannot find peace within his own bubble of life. For man to find peace, it must come from without. And that is the meaning behind the phrase that you'll find 28 times in the book, under the sun. You'll see it, under the sun, under the sun. What is he saying? From this perspective, as far as we can see, right here as a finite man, this is our perspective. This is all we can see. And he's getting us to raise our eyes a little bit and realize there is something beyond this. Because this bubble we've been encased in, where we're trying to fix everything this way, there is someone that is greater than all that. And so he continues to hit. It's vanity. It's all under the sun. We have a limited perspective. And you need something greater than what you've been trying to fill that empty void in your heart with. So let's cut to the chase. I've got to cut through a number of notes here, and let's just go to the end of the book. Look at chapter 12, and we'll close. So if you look at verse 8, those are the bookends. He started in chapter 1, verse 2 with the same phrase, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. So 12 chapters of capturing your attention, saying this is all temporary, it's all worthless, you're living in a bubble and you've lost the meaning of life, it's not this. And then he finishes with what? Verse 13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. What is he saying? Look at those two verses. Keep your eyes on the text because I want you to think about it and I want you to tell me, what is he saying in real life, practical 2015 terms? And you don't have to do the whole thing. There's a couple components in there. What is he telling us? In light of everything we've looked at, Our influence follows after us. Okay. Good. What else? Yes. Okay, so there's a focus. The only thing that brings satisfaction is serving God. So he turns our focus away from us, right? We're looking this way. We're looking at hedonism, materialism. We're looking at work, relationships, all that. And he focuses centers our focus on God. Okay, what else? What's the first component? He says that we are to what? Fear God. What does that mean? What does it mean for you today? Let's not make these nebulous Old Testament terms. What does it mean for you to fear God in 2015? Okay, obedience, because what's the next phrase? Keep his commandments. Okay, that's always a function of fearing God. What else? What's that? Honor him, okay. Trust him, okay, Vicky? Okay, yes, we're getting to another point there too. To not be proud. What else? Anything else? Recognize his sovereignty. He's God and we're not. Yes. Submission. And submission would flow from a heart of humility. Yes, Christine? I'm sorry? We need him, not things. We need God, not things. There was a component there that you brought up as well of humility, which is obviously a common theme we see running through all Scripture, right? What does the Bible consistently say over and over again about humility and pride in terms of how God responds to it? God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. So you have this 12 chapters of painting this picture that unfortunately is so many times very real to us, even in this day and age. And then he summarizes it by going, focus on God, look up, and fear God. You revere him, you honor him, you obey him, you surrender to him, you submit to him, you humble yourselves before him, and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. In other words, you're trying to do so many other things to try to make your life have meaning, and God has made it so simple for you. Fear me and obey me. I tell teenagers, I've told them for years, you have from a scriptural perspective, you have the easiest task in the world. Because you know what God's told you to do? Honor and obey your parents. If you'll honor and obey your parents, you're going to please God, and you're going to do really well there. And if you honor and obey every time, and Solomon boils it down for us, fear God. Don't fear man. Don't worry about work. Don't worry about this, or this. You focus on God. So how does Ecclesiastes fit in the storyline? Very quickly. Number one, it confirms that we live in a fallen and frustrating world as a natural product of our sin. We sinned. We blew it. God has never moved. We're the ones that ran away. So Ecclesiastes really focuses on sin. It makes it upfront and personal. Number two, it demonstrates that life without God has no meaning. That's what was said several times. Oh, did I go back? Sorry. Demonstrates that life without God has no meaning. No problem. Number three, it stresses the truth that meaning in life is only found through an appropriate fear of God. We must fear God. And number four, last, it teaches that since much in life cannot be explained and understood, we must live by faith and not by sight. So when he says the wicked seem to die early, I mean, the wicked continue to live and are blessed, and the righteous die early. Those decisions rest in the hands of whom? God. So we walk by faith and not by sight. We fear God. We keep his commandments. We focus our attention on God alone. Ecclesiastes is a fantastic book. I would encourage you, because we've got 2 weeks. Jill and I will be teaching the children next week. It's our turn. And then the week after, there is something going on. I think Pastor Gary is teaching that week. So that gives me 2 weeks to get well-versed in Song of Solomon, all right? And we need all that time anyway. But so between now and then, read Ecclesiastes, because it's a great book, and then start reading Song of Solomon, and we'll try to figure that out in 2 weeks, okay? Father, thank you for